George Moog worked for Consolidated Edison and had a basement workshop where he would make furniture and tinker with electrical and electronic parts. When his son Robert was still in grade school, he began building ham radios and simple electronics with George. But by high school, Bob had surpassed his father's abilities and was making electronic organs and homemade Geiger counters with parts purchased from Radio Row in Queens. In 1949, he saw a schematic in Radio and Television News magazine for a theremin. A theremin is a weird electric instrument that is played by moving your hands close to antenna to change the pitch of sounds emanating from the machines. Everyone has heard this noise. It's the sound of spaceships and cartoons and cheesy sci-fi films from the 50s. It is most famously used in the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
She's somehow closer now.
Bob and his father tried to build one from scratch, but it didn't work. After getting some help from a few teachers at school, he managed to get the theremin to emit a sound, albeit of the ear-piercing screech variety, but that was enough to focus young Moog's attention on building a proper instrument. He began to consume any and everything he could get his hands on regarding electronic instruments. And by his senior year in high school, he played his own Moogatron electronic organ with the school orchestra. 5 years after reading the article, Bob Moog published the schematics for his improved theremin in Radio and Television News magazine. He also offered completely assembled theremins for sale. For several years, he sold a few kits and assembled a few theremins. Then, Bob made the transition from using vacuum tubes to using transistors, and his new theremin kits began to sell like hotcakes. During this time, he met and married his first wife, Shirley, who was a schoolteacher. After the first day of class, the children began to moo at her because her name was Mrs. Moog, to which Bob simply changed the way he pronounced his last name to the way many of his cousins pronounced his name, Moog. Soon, Moog met musician Herb Deutsch, who had bought one of Moog's theremins. The two began to discuss how difficult it was for electronic musicians in the early 60s, as there was no easy-to-use electronic instrument, as synthesizers at the time took up most of a small room and were nigh possible to operate without a degree in electrical engineering. Moog realized he needed to make an easier-to-use version, and he made two crucial innovations that set his synthesizer apart from all the others. First, he used voltage to control various functions in his synthesizer. A voltage-controlled oscillator, a device that changed the pitch by changing the voltage supplied to the device, set at a ratio of 1 volt per octave. And a voltage-controlled amplifier, which changed the volume by changing the voltage supplied to the device. Next, rather than cramming all the functions into one box, higgledy-piggledy, he put each control function into its own module, allowing the user to choose which functions they wanted to use on a case-by-case basis. In 1964, Moog created a prototype, and immediately Deutsch began to record with it. Soon, he was selling synthesizers to college and avant-garde electronic music performers, which had him just about breaking even. Then, the Beach Boys recorded Good Vibrations with a theremin and wanted to be able to play the instrument live. But the session musician who played the instrument on the single, Paul O.W. Tanner, had no interest in giving up his session work to tour with the Beach Boys. So Walter Sear reached out to Moog and asked if he could create a theremin that could be played with a fretboard, which Moog did, complete with a beautiful walnut cabinet, and that is still played by Mike Love today. In April 1967, Bob put out a new product catalog where he called his instrument a synthesizer for the first time, and he headed out to Los Angeles to the AEM conference, where he was to give a keynote speech about electronic music, and where he would meet Paul Beaver, a musician who owned an instrument rental company and who wanted to become Moog's West Coast distributor for the machine. They set up the synthesizer in a room at the conference, and Beaver reached out to some of his customers to come in and mess around with the new instrument. Beaver and Moog actually brought the synthesizer to a recording session 2 days before the conference, so the first time a Moog was used on a recording was the Zodiac Cosmic Sounds. The company took enough orders from that show in order to convince Moog to stick with it. Later that summer, Beaver would demonstrate the Moog synthesizer at the Monterey Pop Festival and sell several more units, including to Roger McGuinn of the Byrds and Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. The first Moog to show up on a rock record would be on the Doors' Strange Days in 1967.
Strange days have found us.
And a few months later, on the Monkees' Daily Nightly.
Lost in scenes of smoke-filled dreams, find questions but no answers. Startled eyes that sometimes see phantasmagoric splendor. Hero wet down palsy paths with pennies more vendor. Salvation to yours, but just the time it takes to pay the dancer.
The main hurdle at this point was that most musicians and producers were stymied by the patch cords and dials of the Moog, and so Beaver would wind up having to run over to the studios and set them up. Soon they began running seminars and published a book on how to use the Moog. Wendy Carlos graduated from Columbia in 1965 and began working at Gotham Recording Studios as a mastering engineer, tape editor, and disc cutter, where she first encountered Bob and his synthesizers. The two were kindred spirits, both engineers with musical leanings, and she instinctively got the synthesizer, whereas regular musicians would need Moog or Beaver to actually operate the machine for them to get the sounds they were looking for. Carlos would create the first recording of a Moog as a demo for what the machine could do, and in 1968, she would painstakingly create a fully electronic version of Bach's Brandenburg Concertos. That music would become Switched on Bach, which would win 3 Grammys and become the first ever platinum-selling classical record. Mort Garson, the composer for Zodiac Cosmic Sounds, was using a Moog in creating commercial jingles, which made the electronic sounds of the Moog a part of the everyday soundtrack of American life. And in 1969, he composed the music for a short film, Moon Journey that was repeatedly played during the Apollo 11 mission, watched by millions of people across the world, and creating a strong association with space travel and synthesizer music that still persists to this day. Interestingly, the original tapes for Moon Journey were thought lost forever until a copy of the reel surfaced in 2019, and it has been lovingly restored and reissued in 2023 as Journey to the Moon and Beyond, along with other unreleased Garson tracks. The Moog would be used as a way of generating interesting textures, such as Here Comes the Sun from the Beatles' Abbey Road. But the first rock musician to go all in on the Moog, to the point of actually programming it himself on the fly during live performances, was Keith Emerson of Emerson, Lake & Palmer, most prominently on their first big hit song, Lucky Man. Other synthesizers began to make their way into the market and onto other recordings, most famously in Stevie Wonder's three biggest albums of the 70s, Talking Book, Inner Visions, and Fulfillingness's first finale. The story of Wonder's collaboration with synth auteurs Robert Margoulet and Malcolm Cecil is worthy of a whole podcast in its own right, but many of the sounds from those early seminal albums, like the guitar on Superstition, and the wah-wah on Higher Ground, were synthetic creations. The West German music scene in the late 60s and early 70s eschewed the blues-based rock of the US and England and embraced psychedelia and the avant-garde, which included electronic music and synthesizers. Dubbed krautrock by the British music press, the scene included such diverse acts as Can, Tangerine Dream, and Kraftwerk. Tangerine Dream used synthesizers, including a Moog, but also prominently featured sequencers, which were machines built specifically to control synthesizers so that a musician could control several synths at once without having to use a keyboard for each synth. Tangerine Dream made long, slow-developing instrumental tracks that today would be called ambient. Yeah. Kraftwerk were a pretty run-of-the-mill krautrock band. That is until their fourth album, Autobahn, where they fully embraced drum machines and synthesizers, including the new Mini Moog, and rose to international fame. Their 1977 album, Trans Europe Express, remains one of the most important electronic albums, actually re-entering the charts in England in 1982 during the heyday of New Wave. Perhaps the most important song made with a Moog was Donna Summer's I Feel Love, produced by Giorgio Moroder. Moroder's concept for Summer's fifth album was for each track to evoke a musical decade. When it came to the final track, they wanted to evoke the future. And so Moroder asked classical composer Eberhard Schoner if he could use the composer's Moog synthesizer, which Schoner agreed to and asked his assistant Robbie Weddle to show Moroder how to use the instrument. Moroder set about creating a rhythm track. When he completed the first track, which was the now famous bass line, Weddle asked him if he wanted to sync the next track to the one they had just completed. Moroder didn't understand what he was being asked, so Weddle explained that he had put a signal on track 16 of the tape so that each of the following 15 tracks would be linked by the Moog to be exactly the same tempo, a technique that Weddle himself had come up with. This innovation took electronic music from the realm of prog rock, or adding texture to analog music, to becoming the cornerstone of dance music. Weddle also showed Moroder how to make percussion sounds with the Moog by taking white noise and creating an envelope around it so that it starts abruptly and fades out quickly, which sounds like a hi-hat. The only instrumental sound on the finished track that was not created by a synthesizer was the bass drum, which was played by session drummer Keith Forsey. When Moroder went to mix the final track, he asked the engineer to give him a little delay on the bass, which wound up doubling the bass line, an effect that Moroder immediately jumped on. The final mix would push the bass line to the left channel with the delay being in the right, creating an almost strobe-like effect that would blow the minds of clubgoers when it hit discos in 1977. I Feel Love would also be the first song to combine synth loops with a four-on-the-floor bass drum and an offbeat hi-hat, a sound that would become synonymous with techno and house music 10 years in the future. Brian Eno came bursting into the Berlin studio where David Bowie was recording Heroes, waving a copy of the record and proclaiming that he had, quote, the sound of the future, unquote, in his hand, and that it would change the sound of club music for the next 15 years. Patrick Crowley, a pioneer of the high-energy style that would dominate the 80s gay club scene, got his start with an unauthorized 15-minute remix of I Feel Love that was circulated among DJs in clubs in 1978. Martin Ware played I Feel Love and Trans Europe Express to Philip Oakley and told him, "We can do this," prompting their group, then known as The Future, to turn away from Tangerine Dream-style ambient music towards pop and dance music. But we will learn more about the Human League later on. I Feel Love was to new wave music what Rocket 88 was to rock and roll, a signpost pointing towards the future, a record cited by hundreds of bands that came after as one of the reasons they decided to make music in the first place. Simply put, it was the sound of the future. Welcome to Moving in Stereo, a podcast about the history of new wave music told through the stories and the music of the bands who made it. I'm your host, Dylan Johnson. In this episode, we will be covering three of the most important electronic acts of the 70s, one from the United States, one from Japan, and one from the United Kingdom. Alan Vega was a Brooklyn kid, born in 1938 to parents who pushed him to excel in academics and specifically the sciences, but who was more entranced with abstract art and Kerouac's On the Road. When he was 18, he saw Elvis Presley on TV and his entire life changed. He graduated college in 1960 and went on to join the Art Workers Coalition, an organization that successfully pressured the Museum of Modern Art into implementing a free admission day in addition to displaying more art created by women and people of color. Martin Rev was a highly trained jazz piano player who studied under Lenny Tristano. They began to play shows in 1970 under the name Suicide, allegedly taken from the title of a Ghost Rider comic book, Satan Suicide, but that seems unlikely as Ghost Rider, Motorcycle Hero, didn't appear in Marvel Comics before 1972 and didn't get his own title until 1973. Advertising themselves as punk music, they are certainly one of the first to self-identify that way, even if the term, as being used by Lester Bangs at the time, was referring to what we would now call garage rock, and certainly were more punk in ethos than a vast majority of bands that would later lay claim to the mantle. The band were originally a trio, but quickly evolved into a duo, with Vega singing and Rev playing keyboards, and, after discovering their existence in 1971, programming drum machines. Suicide was frequently playing to hostile audiences, and the feeling was mutual. Audiences would often boo before hearing a note, and Vega would frequently perform while brandishing a motorcycle chain to discourage anyone from interrupting the show. And if the crowd wasn't hostile, Vega would harangue them to the point of hostility. Tales abound of shows degenerating into riots. By 1973, Suicide were regulars in Lower Manhattan's burgeoning underground music scene, playing Max's Kansas City and CBGB. In 1976, Suicide had a track, Rocket USA, included on the compilation Max's Kansas City. Finally, in 1977, Suicide was given their shot and went into the recording studio with the aim of, quote, widening rock's vocabulary by getting rid of the guitar and getting rid of the drums, unquote. Their debut album, Suicide, like most every evolutionary record, divided critics between high praise and utter contempt at the time, but is now almost universally recognized as one of the most single influential records of its time. Ghost Rider, Motorcycle Hero. Hey,
truth. America, America's killing its youth.
The centerpiece of the album was the 10-minute Frankie Teardrop, the story of a 20-year-old factory worker whose poverty drives him insane, leading him to murder his wife and child and then kill himself. Not content with being that bleak, the rest of the song is devoted to Frankie's descent into hell.
Frankie, look at his wife. Shut up. What have I done? A tear for Frankie.
Henry Rollins has described Frankie Teardrop as, quote, the single most intense song I've ever heard in my life, unquote. Bruce Springsteen cited the song as an influence on his album Nebraska, and Lou Reed was once quoted as wishing he had written the song himself. The obligatory tour would bring Suicide to the UK, opening for The Clash, where a concert in Glasgow resulted in the band being booed for not being punk because they didn't have guitars, then on to Europe, opening for Elvis Costello, where their set in Brussels resulted in a riot and would be immortalized in their live flexi disc, 23 Minutes of Brussels.
Can we have a microphone back? Otherwise, there's no show. It's not possible. Hey, listen. We just fuck a bunch of poor musicians like every one of you, man. We'd like to have that microphone back. Otherwise, the show don't go on. Please. Please.
Too punk for the punks, too new wave for the new wavers, Suicide seemed destined to slide into obscurity and poverty. But they were artists' artists, and in 1978, The Cars, who we will devote an episode to later this season, hit it big with their debut album and asked Suicide to open for them, and Rick Ocasek offered to produce their next recording sessions. Their first collaboration was the single Dream Baby Dream, which came out in 1979 and featured the band's transition from punk harbingers of doom to new wave detached observers of the human condition.
Dream Baby Dream.
Their second album, Suicide, Alan Vega and Martin Rev, dropped in 1980, and this record also sold poorly, but again found its way to other nascent musicians who would go on to have massive hit records, including several groups that would also feature as synth duos, Soft Cell, Blancmange, Yazoo, and Bronski Beat, all of whom we will be touching on in future episodes. Their next album, A Way of Life, wouldn't show up until 1988 and would feature the hauntingly lovely Surrender, which sadly didn't reach an audience despite sounding like it belonged on an episode of Twin Peaks. Suicide would release occasional albums and play concerts, but never reached anywhere near the level of money and fame as most of the other artists that we will cover in this podcast. But they were chosen as the American representative for this episode on early electronic pioneers of new wave music due to their unflagging commitment to electronic music as art and being more authentically punk than damn near anyone else in that genre, despite never being considered punk themselves. Alan Vega died in his sleep in 2016 at age 78. Martin Rev is still making music today. When I originally mapped out this episode, I had penciled in the Human League as the representative for the English synth group, but I very quickly came to realize that their story is so deep and interesting that it deserves its own episode. So instead of bringing you the story of one of the pioneers of the British synthesizer sound, I'm going to bring you the story of a guy who, with one television appearance on Top of the Pops in 1979, made millions of kids in England throw out their older siblings' punk records and start buying anything that had electronic instruments in it. Anything new wave. Gary Anthony James Webb was born in 1958 in Hammersmith, London, the son of a British Airways bus driver who worked at Heathrow Airport. When Webb was 15, his father bought him a Gibson Les Paul guitar. He would spend the remainder of his teenage years auditioning for various bands around London, eventually joining a group known as Mean Street and the Lasers. Where he met bassist Paul Gardner. Soon Webb's uncle, Jess Lydiard, would join as drummer, and the band would change their name to Tubeway Army, with Webb adopting the stage name Valerian, Gardner becoming Scarlet, and Lydiard choosing the name Rael. The band began gigging around the London punk scene and were signed to Beggar's Banquet in the signing frenzy of 1977. They released the single That's Too Bad in early 1978, which failed to dent the charts. Look up and look at my eyes, searching my room. The TV screen is calling me for one of them. Please, Mr. TV, Kevin, I'm so fragile. Maybe you don't let me down this beat this place for a while. The group recorded a few more demos, and then a second single, Bombers, which also failed to chart in the summer of 1978. By this time, the London punk scene was pretty violent, and after a gig that had to be abandoned due to violence in the audience, Tubeway Army gave up live gigs and became a strictly studio act. As part of the transition, Valerian changed his name to Gary Newman after seeing a listing for a plumber named Newman in the London phone book. At this point, fate intervenes. The band went into the studio to record their punk songs, but a mini Moog synthesizer had been left in the studio by a previous act, and the instrumental rental company hadn't shown up to collect it, so Newman set about playing around with it. After 3 days, the group had completed their album, but instead of a punk record, they submitted a weird dystopian science fiction piece with lyrics cribbed from J.G. Ballard and Philip K. Dick.
Flow my tears, the new police song. The slogan of peace is you must live.
they've got me, and I'm one of them.
Cancel silence, they screamed for days. We've been here before, we won't stay.
Also, Newman told the label that the album wasn't a Tube Way Army album, but should be credited to Gary Newman. Needless to say, Beggar's Banquet were livid. They were a small label and had no money to fix the record, and they certainly weren't going to abandon the name of a group they just spent their money on, so they very begrudgingly released 5,000 copies of Tube Way Army with no single and no promotional push. The initial pressing sold out, prompting the label to grant Tube Way Army a second album. By this point, the band had added keyboardists Billy Curry, most recently from Ultravox, and Chris Payne, and replaced Lydiard with drummer Cedric Sharpley. Newman doubled down on the sci-fi themes, this time writing a loose concept album based around a dystopian future cribbed from Philip K. Dick's book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?, which itself would be adapted by director Ridley Scott into the film Blade Runner 3 years later. The lead single from Replicas, the atmospheric Down in the Park, wasn't successful, but has since been covered by Marilyn Manson, Foo Fighters, and Nine Inch Nails. One of the instrumental tracks, I Nearly Married a Human, would be used as background music for Carl Sagan's Watershed Cosmos television program. But the second single, Our Friends Electric, would change the trajectory of British music for the next several years. The song itself was staggeringly simple, with a simple recurring synth riff with conventional drums and bass and some heavily flanged guitars, and lyrics about an android prostitute coming over to visit. The track did okay, getting some mild radio play. That is until Tube Way Army were invited to perform on Top of the Pops. The band appeared in all black and were near motionless throughout the performance, while Newman, complete with white pancake makeup and dark eyeliner, moved in a stiff robotic fashion, and then the song absolutely took off, reaching number one on the British charts for 4 weeks, making an instant star of Gary Newman, and unleashing a horde of synth bands upon the British charts. Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Ultravox, Visage, and Spando Ballet. For an encore, Tube Way Army split up. Although all of the current members would appear on Newman's debut solo album, The Pleasure Principle, mainly because that album was already half completed at the time that Our Friends Electric hit number one in England. This album would noticeably feature no guitars on it at all. The lead single was based on a road rage incident in which a group of men hopped out of their work van and tried to assault Newman, who locked his doors and drove away. He wrote a song about how being in a car was like being in a safe little bubble with the chaos of the world all around you.
Here in my car.
Newman composed the song on a bass guitar, an instrument he had not previously played before, hence the simple nature of the melody. The track was intended to be instrumental, which is why there are very few lyrics in the song, leading Newman to joke that he often plays keyboards on the track live, quote, just to have something to do other than just stand there, unquote. Cars would be his second number one in England, and would go to number one in Canada and top 10 in the United States, becoming his only US hit. Newman would top the UK charts again in 1980 with Teclon, which spawned three more hit singles, This Wreckage, I Die, You Die, and We Are Glass. His next record, Dance, expanded from his familiar electropop sound to add some jazz and funk elements and yielded yet another top 10 single in the UK, She's Got Claws. Bassist Paul Gardner also released his first solo album in 1981, which featured Newman on vocals for his only UK hit, Stormtrooper in Drag. Newman's fourth studio album, 1992's I, Assassin, would feature the fretless bass of Pino Palladino as lead melody instrument. And his final UK top 10 hit, We Take Mystery to Bed. Newman continued to release music throughout the rest of the 80s with varying degrees of success, and most of his material from 1984 through the end of the decade is sadly out of print and unavailable to stream on most streaming services, with the exception of a few tunes on compilation. Experienced a career resurgence in the late 90s as he embraced a raw industrial sound. In 2012, he moved to Santa Monica with his wife and three daughters, where he still lives today. Gary Newman's latest album, Intruder, came out in 2021, and he is currently touring with Ministry and Frontline Assembly. The United States and England were not the only places where electronic music rose to prominence in the late 70s. In the late 60s, Japanese composer Isao Tomita heard Wendy Carlos's Switched on Bach and immediately set about acquiring a Moog 3 synthesizer. Tomita created several important works of early electronica, including Snowflakes Are Dancing, which was significant in its creation of a polyphonic sound in an era before a polyphonic synthesizer existed, by recording the same sections over and over on individual tracks, in addition to being an early adopter of sequencers to create new effects. His most well-known track in the United States is probably Arabesque No. 1, which was used as the theme to PBS's Jack Horkheimer Star Hustler series. Tomita, in turn, inspired three musicians, Ryuichi Sakamoto, Haruomi Hosono, and Yukio Takahashi, to form an electronic band in 1978 called Yellow Magic Orchestra. Sakamoto became interested in electronic music while attending the Tokyo National University of Fine Arts and Music starting in 1970. While at the university, he got to use Moog, Buchla, and ARP synthesizers and began his career as a session musician. Takahashi was the drummer for the Sadistic Mika Band, a name chosen to parody John Lennon's Plastic Ono Band, a groundbreaking Japanese glam rock band, who were the first Japanese rock band to tour England when they opened for Roxy Music on their 1975 Siren tour. Bassist Hosono enjoyed fame as a member of the Japanese psychedelic band April Fool, as well as being a founding member of the folk rock group Happy End. Happy End is most famous in Japan for the Nihongo Roku Ronso, or the Japanese language rock controversy. In a nutshell, previous to Happy End's debut album, virtually all rock music in Japan was sung in English, while folk music was sung in Japanese. Happy End fused the two, playing rock music paired with poetic Japanese lyrics, creating a whole new sound and genre of music, Japanese rock. During the early 70s, Hosono was a session player for several records that featured synthesizer, Osamu Kitajima's album, Benzaiten. When Happy End disbanded in 1974, Hosono began to play in the exotica style, and he recruited Sakamoto and Takahashi to play on his solo album, Parayaso. which was credited to Harry Hosono and the Magic Yellow Band. The name was satirizing the Japanese obsession with black magic that was quite prevalent in the mid-70s. The trio then contributed three tracks to the 1978 album Pacific. That also featured three tracks by Sugeru Suzuki, who had been in Happy End with Hosono and was now enjoying a successful solo career, and two tracks by Tatsuro Yamashita, who was still 2 years away from becoming a superstar in Japan, and of whom we will dedicate more time in a future episode. Sakamoto released a solo record, Thousand Knives, in 1978, which would feature the first recorded usage of the Roland MC8 microcomposer, a sequencer that was revolutionary at the time for its upgrade to 16 kilobytes of RAM instead of the 512 bytes of sequencers up until that time. The trio changed their name to Yellow Magic Orchestra and recorded their eponymous debut album in 1978. The group made a conscious decision to make electronic music that was the opposite of most of the electronic music that had come before, namely the dreamy, ambient soundscapes of Tangerine Dream and the regimented dystopian songs of Kraftwerk. Yellow Magic Orchestra was deliberately trying to make feel-good pop music while also keeping the feel of classic Japanese music. But perhaps the most important member of the band wasn't a member of the band, Hideki Matsutake. Matsutake began his career as an assistant to Tomita in the early 1970s, and by the mid-70s, he was helping Ryuichi Sakamoto program the synths for his solo albums and was recruited to fill the same role for Yellow Magic Orchestra. Matsutake would not only program the sequencers and synthesizers for In the Studio, but he would fulfill the same role during live shows, loading up the next song samples and sequences on stage while the band was performing the previous song live. The group chose the Martin Denny Exotica song Firecracker, which exoticized Asian sounds in what is now termed Orientalism, and reclaimed it from a Japanese perspective. That song was a big hit in Japan and brought the band to the attention of an international audience. That song would chart in the United States and England in 1979, and then chart again in both countries when combined with Computer Game later that year, hitting the R&B top 20 in the US and the pop top 20 in England. Their follow-up LP, Solid State Survivor, would be their best-selling album in Japan and feature the international hit Behind the Mask. That single was covered by Eric Clapton, The Human League, who we will be discussing in a future episode, and Michael Jackson, who earmarked the track for the Thriller album, but disagreements between Jackson's and Yellow Magic Orchestra's management prevented the release of the song until after Jackson's death. Yellow Magic Orchestra then embarked on their first tour of the United States and England, as memorialized in their first live record, Public Pressure, which came out in early 1980. Sakamoto's second solo record also dropped in 1980 and contained Riot in Lagos, which has been cited by Afrika Bambaataa and Mantronix as a direct influence on the development of their music, now known as electro music. Bambaataa in particular would sample Yellow Magic Orchestra in his famous Death Mix in 1983. Their third LP, X Infinity Sign Multiples, came out in 1980 and was another huge hit in Japan, just as interest in the United States was peaking based on the delayed success of Firecracker computer games. The album was an odd mix of electronic and rock music interspersed with comedy sketches from The Snake Man Show, but contained both the influential Rydeen and their cover of Archie Bell and the Drells' Tighten Up, which Yellow Magic Orchestra would lip-sync during their appearance on the American TV show Soul Train. Japanese gentleman, stop, please. 1981 saw the release of two more Yellow Magic Orchestra LPs, BGM and Technodelic. BGM featured one of the earliest recorded uses of the Roland T808 drum machine. Give me a cue. I think I've nearly found you. Psychedelic is widely recognized as the first album to feature mainly samples and loops. The band accomplished this with an LMD-649, a custom-made sampler developed by Toshiba EMI engineer Kenji Murata that was the world's first digital sampler. Years later, the band were back with Naughty Boys, the last synth-pop album to top the charts in Japan until the genre's revival in 2008. In 1983, the group released their final studio album of the 80s, Service, which featured the single, You've Got to Help Yourself. Yellow Magic Orchestra released the musical motion picture Propaganda in 1984, a film that combined footage of their final tour performances at Budokan with surreal vignettes following a young fan traversing a weird landscape in pursuit of his idols, Yellow Magic Orchestra. Then the three members returned to their solo careers, being careful to declare that they were Sankai, a Japanese phrase meaning spreading out, and not breaking up. They reunited in 1993 for a one-off album, Technodon, which featured field recordings and samples of authors and scientists reading their work instead of singing lyrics. Hosono and Takahashi formed a group called Sketch Show in the early 2000s, and Sakamoto joined them on several occasions. In fact, he participated frequently enough that they adopted a new name whenever Sakamoto played with them, Human Audio Sponge. Eventually, this led to a full-blown reunion in 2007, with Yellow Magic Orchestra playing at the Live Earth Kyoto event in July. They released a new single in 2009 and performed at two festivals in Europe. From 2010 to 2012, they were the final act of the Happiness Festival in Japan, and in 2011, they played several dates in the United States, including the Hollywood Bowl. In 2012, they also headlined the No Nukes 2012 Music Festival in Chiba, Japan. The band again went on hiatus, with members working on solo projects. Hosono toured England, and on his June 23, 2018 show, Takahashi and Sakamoto joined him on stage in London and performed Absolute Ego Dance. It would be the last time Yellow Magic Orchestra would appear on stage together. On January 11, 2023, Takahashi died at age 70 of pneumonia after declining health following a surgery to remove a brain tumor in 2020. On March 28, 2023, Sakamoto died at age 71 following a lengthy battle with cancer. Hosono is still composing music, most recently music for films, which was released in 2021. Yellow Magic Orchestra were one of the pioneers of synthpop and contributed more to the sound of new wave music than virtually any other artist you can think of. You've been listening to Moving in Stereo, a podcast about new wave music and the artists who made it. Moving in Stereo was written, produced, and performed by me, Dylan Johnson. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to like and follow and please tell a friend.